Welcome to Willoughby Hills. I'm Heath Rosella. Got a great new show for you today. Thank you for being here. Thank you for joining me. My guest today is Sarah McCammon. Sarah's a national political correspondent for NPR, co-host of the NPR Politics podcast, and she has a great new book out. It's called The Ex-Evangelicals, Loving, Living, and Leaving the White Evangelical Church. So this idea of an ex-evangelical is really interesting to me, and Sarah's going to get into it today and certainly throughout her book. But people that have grown up in a religious community, in this case specifically the White Evangelical Church, and at some point have decided, I think I need to question what's going on here. I think I need to get outside of this bubble, and I think I need to start thinking for myself and coming up with a different version of the world than the one that I've been brought up in. So that's kind of the basis for this book. And it's interesting because Sarah comes at it from both talking to people, reporting on their experiences, but also her own personal experience of having grown up in a very evangelical household, a white evangelical household in Kansas City, and then starting to unwind that faith as she got older and moved away from home. I've been following Sarah's work since at least 2016. She was one of the reporters embedded with the Trump campaign, covering it for NPR back in the day. Started following her on the site formerly known as Twitter, and you know, getting updates. This was the time when it was kind of flabbergasting, I think, to certainly a lot of white Americans like myself, this idea that somebody who was being so sexist and xenophobic and things in his rallies could continue to get so much political acclaim and ultimately go on to win the nomination and the White House and yada, yada, yada. But I mean, at the time, there was violence erupting at some of these rallies. I mean, I remember a guy punching someone in the face, and, you know, just every rally seemed to be a continuing escalation. And so I started following a lot of the embedded reporters that were there on the campaign trail day in, day out. And what was always interesting to me about Sarah's reporting is I could tell that she understood the evangelical piece of Trumpism in a way that a lot of other reporters didn't. And it felt personal, but it's not always a reporter's job to talk about their own experience or to explicitly bring their own experience into their reporting. Obviously, they're going to have a point of view just based on their worldview and things, but I think Sarah could speak the language without having to explicitly state, yes, I grew up evangelical. And I understood that and frankly wanted to learn more. So I heard this book was coming out, was very eager to read it, and it does not disappoint. It's a really, really great read and really eye-opening as far as what is happening in white evangelical spaces. Really over the last, you know, 40 or so years, you know, Reagan, you know, James Dobson and Jerry Falwell, figures like this play prominently in this book as well. So yeah, Sarah grew up in a very white evangelical household and brings her experience of deconstructing her own faith into this memoir, as well as bringing in other people's stories, which I really appreciated. For myself, there was a lot of resonance here. I grew up in a very Catholic family. I had grandmothers on both sides that regularly prayed the rosary and were very, very devout. I grew up going to, you know, Catholic after-school programs. I wasn't in a full-time Catholic school, but definitely went to religious classes and went through the whole communion and confirmation and confession and all those different rites. And I mean, at one time even considered briefly potentially going into the priesthood. That was something that I felt strongly about when I was younger. Didn't materialize, and I'm very thankful that it didn't. But yeah, I come from a similar devout background, I would say, that I've had to do my own deconstructing of that and really think about what were the things that I was taught, what are the things that I agree with from that, what are the things that I need to separate myself from, and ultimately get into a place where I no longer consider myself Catholic. Certainly haven't for more than a decade. And, you know, I go back and forth between atheist, agnostic, somewhere in the middle. And I've kind of settled on the idea that it is not our place as humans to understand the divine. whatever that means, whether that is multiple gods, whether that is a singular God who created everything, whether that is nature and spirits and our human connection to all of that. I think all of those things can be true, and they can equally be false, I guess. And so we just need to feel a connection to each other, to the natural world, and do what feels right to us. That's not to discount people that have religious views or find comfort in religion, but I think the portrait of the white evangelical church, certainly over the last 40 years that Sarah paints in this book, is one of control, is one of pushing a very specific worldview, which translates into politics and media consumption and lots of other things that we're going to get into today. A lot to unpack in this conversation today, a lot of really interesting stuff. If you're interested in learning more, I highly recommend you go read Sarah's book, The Ex-Evangelicals, Loving, Living, and Leaving the White Evangelical Church. And yes, that white evangelical church is a deliberate framing. We're going to talk about that today as well, around some of the racism involved in the white evangelical spaces and some of the segregation that exists in these spaces as well. So lots to dive into. Before we get to the conversation, I want to remind you that I have a newsletter that I publish twice a week, every Wednesday and every Sunday. If you're interested in getting on that list and learning more about what's going on in my life, what I'm learning about in the world, what I'm reading, what I'm thinking about, go to heathrasella.com/newsletter. Enter your email there to get on the list. And if you'd like to support this work that I'm doing, if you learn things from this podcast, if you feel like you are growing and changing and seeing the world differently because of these interviews, I encourage you to upgrade to a paying membership as well. It helps keep this project going. It helps financially to support what I'm doing here on this show. And I appreciate every member, whether you're a paying member or a free member, either way, heathrasella.com/newsletter. I encourage you to go see what I'm doing over there. All right, a lot to get into today. I hope you will enjoy this conversation. Here it is, my interview with Sarah McCammon. I've got to say, I was a little surprised reading the book because I didn't expect it to be as personal as it was. It's kind of part memoir and part reporting and talking to other people that have been through similar experiences. I'm curious sort of if that was the intent all along, or if it was, you know, memoir first and then you brought in these other stories, or if it was other people first and you said, oh, you know, I want to tell my own story as a part of, like, just talk to me, I guess, about the evolution of the writing of this.
I always envisioned it as a hybrid of memoir and reporting. I came across the term, I talk about this in the book, but I came across the term ex-evangelical while doing my reporting on the 2016 campaign and the evangelical movement's relationship to Trump. And obviously, I had my own deep history with the evangelical movement, which I, as a reporter, didn't usually talk about, you know, because that's not what you typically do.
Sure.
But of course, it informed the way that I understood what was happening, the questions that I asked, the themes that I picked up on, because, you know, I understood that community so deeply, and I had had my own kind of slow unwinding from my own religious tradition when I was much younger. And, you know, I talk about a lot of the reasons in the book, some of them having to do with basically just wanting to include people that I felt weren't included the way that I was raised, people like my gay grandfather, like my Muslim friend that I met in high school and people like that. And so that was my story. And then I heard this word ex-evangelical, and I just thought, you know, that word just sort of says a lot in one simple word. It says you were once part of something and you're now not. And I had, you know, over the years thought a lot about what it meant to be part of the evangelical subculture, you know, the ways that it shaped me, the ways that we did things differently. And so I was thinking about a lot of that as I was covering the campaign. So really from the beginning, I spent a number of years thinking about what I might want to say about that sort of intersection of my personal background and my professional work, which happened really by accident.
Sure.
But it gave me kind of a unique perch. And it was something that, you know, when people who did know my history would hear my reporting, they would ask me about a lot. But I never wanted to just tell my story. You know, like I started paying attention to these ex-evangelical spaces on social media and, you know, podcasts, and there started to be kind of more and more books around some of these themes or pieces of it. And I thought, you know, there's kind of something happening here. There's this moment in our politics, which is so divisive, and also divisive in churches, is kind of generating and catalyzing a conversation about what it means to be evangelical, and for many people, what it means to not be anymore.
Yeah.
And so that was really the genesis of the idea. And I have to say, you know, I spent a long time kind of putting a book proposal together, thinking about exactly what I wanted to do. And I had two bids, two different publishers interested in the book, but St. Martin's really got the vision for the hybrid, the weaving together my story and others, which was really important to me. And so I was, you know, I was so pleased that I was able to work with an editor who really shared that vision and helped me, I think, execute what I always kind of wanted to do from the beginning.
Sure. I mean, I can imagine, like, when you're doing an NPR piece, there's a deadline, right? Like, you're going to have a report on air at 5 o'clock or whatever it is, and you're kind of working towards that. With a book, there's obviously a deadline as well. But, like, I guess I was interested, just the people that you talk to, some of them come back several times throughout the story. And other times, I mean, like, right up to the last or second to last chapter, there's new characters getting introduced. Like, for you, just going out and hearing these stories and talking to these people, when did you know that you had enough? And when did you feel like, oh, you know what? I should do a couple more interviews. I should talk to this, you know, friend of a friend says you should meet this person. Like, I could imagine that temptation to just keep going was probably there too.
I mean, for sure. And, you know, as I've been a reporter for a long time, and one thing I've learned is that not reporting enough is a problem, but over-reporting is also too much.
Yeah.
Because you end up with just an unwieldy amount of information and you find yourself trying to cram it all in, and it just can be counterproductive. So I think I've developed, I hope in 20 plus years as a journalist now, I've developed kind of stronger instincts about when I'm done, and it's at least as much of an art as a science. So I organize the book thematically, more or less.
Sure.
You know, each chapter is kind of about a source of tension or cognitive dissonance, you know, whether it's thematic. So, you know, the evangelical relationship to science, to sexuality, to women, to, you know, people of other faiths, politics. There's sort of a thematic organization, and some of those themes sort of lead to the next theme.
Yeah.
So I kind of thought about each theme as almost like an individual story. Mm. And I wanted to make sure I had a good mix of people who could share their experiences, and then, you know, some of my own experiences, and then data and reporting and research. And so I kind of knew, I mean, in some chapters are more heavy for one, and some are more heavy for the other. I mean, the chapter on Black Christians with experience in white evangelical spaces is more about other people, since that's not my experience.
Sure.
The ones about my grandfather are more about me. I think I just kind of had a feel for it. And then, you know, as I went back and did revisions over the second, basically it was like a 2-year process. So the first year was writing it, and the second year was a lot of revising and editing. I did go back and talk to a few more people or add in a little bit more material. If I was going through and just kind of felt like there was an idea that was missing, and occasionally I would run across somebody on social media or in my personal life who had something to add, and I'd think, you know, I really want to get that in. And fortunately, I had the time.
Nice. I'm curious too. I think you mentioned your own unwinding, you called it, in the book, you call it deconstructing, the process of deconstructing faith and kind of unwinding that evangelical childhood for people. Can you define what that means? Just what is deconstructing, and what are people doing with it?
I mean, that's been the interesting thing for me as I've been paying more attention to some of these mostly online conversations, which I interestingly think have seeped into the real world. Like, I was finishing up my book proposal and I was at a wedding in DC in the fall of 2021. And somebody mentioned, you know, we were talking about who knew the bride and who knew the groom. And somebody said, you know, there are a lot of ex-evangelical types here. And I was like, whoa, you know, that's a word that's actually permeated, like, it's come off the internet.
Yeah.
But, you know, when I was going through my own, well, often a really painful process of rethinking my own beliefs, it was very lonely. I felt, you know, I had been warned that, you know, the world will try to persuade you and pull you away from God. And I was very scared of some of the questions I had about everything from, like, how the Bible was put together to how old the earth was to whether or not gay people could be Christians and all this stuff. It was all very scary because I had been strongly encouraged to have strong beliefs about those things and not to change them.
Yeah.
And so there wasn't a language, there wasn't a word like ex-evangelical, there wasn't a word like deconstruction. But as I started paying more attention to ex-evangelical spaces, I started coming across other words like deconstruction. You know, it's not just evangelicals that use that term. It's also, I've seen ex-Mormons and even, I think, ex-Catholics, various people from sort of, you know, more traditional or more conservative traditions who are also going, okay, how much of this aligns with who I am and how much of it doesn't? But I guess I would just define deconstruction, and I think the way most people define it is it has something to do with that rethinking, with sort of taking the package of ideas you've been given by your community, usually a religious community, and assessing them, considering them, often doing a lot of research. It may involve researching church history. It may involve researching sort of biblical criticism and just a lot of soul searching, too, and trying to come to a place of, if not, you know, definitive, here's what I think, at least more ease with some of those questions and concerns.
Yeah. I mean, there is something that I felt very deeply in the book, coming up from a Catholic tradition myself, and since leaving the church and, you know, trying to understand that through most of my like early adult years of just like, wait, am I still Catholic? Am I not? You know, but you mentioned it there of just kind of this set of worldviews that are meant not to be questioned. And even, I mean, simple thing, like you talk about in the book, like the question of if a friend hasn't accepted Jesus, but it's because, or someone just in the world, you know, because they live somewhere where there's not a Christian faith. They're, you know, in the middle of India somewhere in a mountain, and you're like, they've never been exposed to it. They're going to go to hell, really? And like, I would ask my religious teachers this too, and they'd be like, you have to have faith. And like, there was no,
right.
There was no room for any kind of, questioning or pushback. Like for you, that process of starting to ask those questions and starting to ask things that you were told were not to be asked, I guess, like how did that whole process start for you? And when did it start to kind of snowball to the point that you said, okay, like I need a different label for myself?
I think it started in many ways. Probably the first time I was told to pray for my grandpa to not go to hell, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, of course, as a little child, I believed what I was told. There were a lot of reasons I liked being in the evangelical community, you know? I liked this idea that God loves us and that Jesus loves us is really beautiful. And the idea that we kind of knew what we were supposed to be doing with our lives on earth and that, you know, God had given us very clear directions in the Bible, which were, of course, being interpreted by the community, but were still thought of as very clear and obvious. There's like a comfort in that in a way, because it's a big world.
Sure,
and
yeah.
I don't know if you can relate to that at
totally,
all from growing
up
Catholic.
Absolutely.
But I also like found that those sort of structures also excluded a lot of people, and that really didn't sit well with me. I mean, from an early age. And I think especially as I got a little bit older, like into high school, I remember, you know, this was the 90s and there was starting to be a real big conversation about same-sex marriage. And I remember just having a hard time understanding, like, I believed at that time the Bible says that homosexual relationships are sinful. And so I would have said, yes, I believe that. But I had a hard time even then understanding, like, why that should be a political issue, you know, like why we should impose that view on other people. Because I could see that it was a religious view.
Yeah.
You know, I knew my grandpa. I didn't see any harm that was coming from him being in a relationship with a man. And so it was, you know, those were a couple of things. Also, I know Catholicism has been okay with evolution for a long time now, but, you know, my branch of evangelicalism was not. And so it became clearer to me as I, you know, I'd go to science museums or go to the library and look at books about dinosaurs. And it was clear that everybody pretty much thought that the earth was a lot older than we were being told. And, you know, we were told that was because scientists had tried to come up with a way to erase God and explain away the existence of God, and that the reason people believed in evolution was to try to avoid accountability to God. But that didn't make a lot of sense to me, because it really seemed like scientists were probably responding to evidence that they, from research they were doing, and like especially as I got a little bit older and realized that there were lots of Christians that were fine with evolution, that piece of it for me was very destabilizing, because it felt like I had been told something that was pretty obviously false and had been told it adamantly true. And this is something you cannot move on, because it will lead to your whole view of scripture and therefore of the faith unraveling. And maybe that was like a self-fulfilling prophecy on their part. I don't know.
Yeah,
but
right.
It was just a lot of things, you know, and But I have to say, like, I've never been someone who is like angry at God or Christianity or religion per se. And some people are, and that's okay. But for me, it was never about like, you know, oh, I hate all of these people or I hate this whole idea. It was really about wanting to have space and freedom to acknowledge what seemed to be right in front of me.
Yeah.
And to follow my questions and to follow my sort of care for people like my grandfather, you know, that desire became overwhelming for me. And I couldn't keep myself in kind of what felt like a small box that I was told I was supposed to stay in intellectually.
Yeah. I mean, you would think in a lot of other places, you want your ideas to be scrutinized, right? Like you want to be questioned and hear another point of view and say, oh, wait a second. Yeah, I hadn't thought of it that way. Maybe this is the solution to my problem. You know, whether it's scientific or artistic or what, like it's nice to hear that. And it, very much I felt in the faith that it was always like, no, don't question that. And there's also an interesting tension that you touch on in the book that I definitely felt growing up of God and Jesus, and a lot of the evangelical kids that I went to school with kind of had this feeling of like, they're all loving, they're like my best friend, they're there for me, but that can turn on a dime too. Like, you know, obviously murder or rape or some, there's terrible things that you can do that, you know, you should be punished for, I would say. But any slight infraction, like there was this feeling of waiting for God to catch you. And you talk a lot about that, of kind of being brought up in that environment, and that for a lot of people, yourself and others that have been through this, it's almost a trauma response. And it can, you know, it can be similar to like a PTSD or other traumatic events that people have been through to kind of unwind.
Yeah. And it's, I mean, it can feel kind of weird to say that because it's like, oh, religion, a lot of people are raised with religion. What's the big deal?
Yeah.
But in talking to trauma counselors and, you know, a number of therapists I interviewed for the book, and particularly the chapter on religious trauma, you know, there's, I think, a growing understanding of the fact that while religion can be very, you know, in if done right, I guess, it can be very helpful for people. It can give them purpose and connection and community. There are ways in which it can be a source of trauma, particularly if you talk about things like clergy sex abuse that are sure, in and of themselves traumatic, that then happen in a religious context. Like that's another sort of layer of pain and harm, that it happened in a place where you're supposed to be trusting somebody with your very soul. But even aside from things like that, you know, one of the researchers I talked to said some of the ways that people respond with having sort of flashbacks and, you know, really visceral fears about things like hell or the rapture, which is another, you know, big idea in evangelicalism. But that, you know, that's sort of a classic trauma response pattern. And so I think there's a greater recognition that that can be part of people's experience and something that they then have to sort of unpack.
Yeah.
As adults.
You mentioned reporting on the Trump 2016 campaign, and sort of that moment coupled with ex-evangelical becoming part of the zeitgeist, you know, people leaving the church. Like, talk to me, I guess, just about the intersection of all of those different things and sort of you being at the nexus of all of that and being able to kind of observe what was like when you first went out on the campaign trail and were reporting from these Trump rallies. What was your impression of what was happening, and where did you see parallels to sort of the culture that you had grown up in?
I mean, first of all, I should say that, you know, a Trump rally is made up of a whole lot of different people. But sure, if you look at, you know, if you look at data, and I would meet people in the course of my reporting who were at least some kind of conservative Christian, Catholic or Protestant. But, you know, 80% of white evangelicals voted for Trump in the last two elections. Exit polls suggest that they were instrumental in making him the nominee this time around. You know, his rallies have increasingly taken on religious themes. And you know, there's been a lot of talk about that the last couple of weeks with his, you know, Trump Bible or the God Bless the USA Bible right, he was selling on Truth Social. Some of the language around that was very explicitly about, you know, Christianity being under siege and the nation needing to go back to a Christian, you know, history or connection to Christianity. But this isn't the first time he said things like that. And, you know, I did I did hear notes of that in his earlier campaign. I mean, even this idea of making America great again, which is something that he would talk about at, you know, every rally, it was his motto. I argue that that tapped into a longstanding idea in white evangelicalism that, you know, America had this sort of glorious Christian past that it had fallen away from. You know, he made a point to court evangelical leaders early on, and I did some reporting on that. You know, he had this big meeting in New York with like 1,000 evangelical and conservative Catholic pastors and ministry leaders and political leaders to basically try to seal the deal just as he was about to become the nominee. And the message, you know, that he directed at voters would talk about protecting Christianity and choosing conservative Supreme Court justices. He promised to overturn Roe v. Wade, which is, you know, an issue that white evangelicals overwhelmingly cared about and continue to care about, abortion.
Yeah.
So, you know, I saw all of those things, all of those themes. I heard them. They sounded familiar and reminiscent of kind of what the things that people would talk about growing up. And then, you know, a lot of sometimes the individual people that I would meet, most of them would express at least some kind of a Christian faith in a sense that, you know, Trump was going to stand up for them. Whether or not they saw him as actually one of them is a different question.
Yeah. But I mean, there is something from afar. I haven't been to a Trump rally or anything, but just in watching his campaign very closely, in watching the presidency, and watching kind of what's happened since he's left office, there's definitely, I think, a connection you could make between him as some sort of idol or something, and, you know, the way that a lot of people might view a pastor or some other religious leader, not quite infallible, but bordering on that, I guess. And just, you know, we're going to take his word seriously and stand up for him. It's something that, I mean, the 2016 race in particular was a very crowded Republican primary. What was it that Trump was able to tap into that other Republicans and perhaps more sincere Christian Republicans couldn't tap into as well?
You know, it's a good question. I think I'm better at answering why they support him, why evangelicals support him now. They've seen him as someone, they've seen him deliver on their goals, right? Yeah. They've seen him explicitly promise to, you know, protect Christianity, to prioritize their objectives. And he did that. I mean, he delivered on the overturning of Roe v. Wade through his appointment of 3 conservative justices while he was president. And I think that they see that and they like it. But, you know, why did they vote for him in the first place? I mean, I think that is a bigger question. Like in 2016, part of it, I don't think it was just white evangelicals, because, you know, if remembering back to early on in the primary, there were so many candidates. And I think Trump was just, in many ways, he was just something different. You know, he stood out. He was a celebrity. I think many Republicans, including many white evangelicals, were attracted to some degree to this sort of strength that he projected. You know, I would hear, even this year, talking to a pastor in Iowa who was supporting Trump. You know, you hear things like, well, he's a fighter. He's going to fight for us.
Yeah.
And so I think that was part of the appeal. I think also some of it in 2016 was simply the fact that there was sort of an evangelical conservative Christian lane, right? Like Ben Carson or Ted Cruz.
Yep.
There was sort of an outsider lane, you know, newcomers, Carly Fiorina and also Ben Carson. There was the more establishment lane, people like, of course, Jeb Bush and to some extent Rubio. And you might also put Rubio in that somewhat evangelical appealing category. But nobody had like sort of the critical mass to get enough of those voters in one block to take on Trump. And I think Trump was just this juggernaut because he was so different and he kind of just busted up all the categories and all the existing lanes of the Republican Party in a way that nobody really expected. And once he had done that, and then he got the support of people like Jerry Falwell, and then really, you know, again, actively courted a lot of evangelical leaders and was able to sort of marshal more of their support once they were on his team and he was the presumptive nominee. I mean, that was it. You know, 80% of white evangelicals voted for him. They would tell me they were never going to vote for Hillary Clinton. Yeah. Because whatever Trump's moral failures may have been, they knew that he agreed with their policy goals. And again, he had promised to sort of fight for them. And I think for a lot of evangelicals and other Christian conservatives, that was a big part of the appeal.
I think there were people, it's interesting you started that answer about like talking about nowadays, because I think you could argue in 2016, there were people that were holding their nose and voting for him with the hope that he would overturn Roe or something like that. There's still people that support him now going into 2024. They don't just support him, and they're not doing it to hold their nose, but they are actively rooting for him and, you know, holding the flags and the Trump hats and, you know, whatever it is. Like, they're fully on board this Trump train, and it doesn't seem like there's any way to turn that back. And I mean, you talk about it in the book, that kind of the evangelical movement and Trumpism have kind of morphed at this point into a singular entity.
And well,
like, those are two different things, I guess, right? Of like holding your nose to support him, to support your own interests, and being fully on board now. Like, is it just that he delivered on policy, you think, that did that? Or are there, I mean, you mentioned rhetoric, I guess, too, and just kind of that tough guy thing.
Yeah, I would go back to those two things. I mean, I think it's policy, it's alignment with the objectives of the group, and it's also this, you know, tough talk about standing up for Christianity, restoring Christianity, and he's really leaning into it. I mean, just the other day, you know, he said that after there was the big outcry about Trans Visibility Day happening to fall on Easter Sunday, because the date was, which it's been for many years, is the same as Easter Sunday. There was a big outcry, of course, by conservative media and a lot of conservative Christians who framed that as an attack on Christianity, even though Biden is himself a devout Catholic. And then Trump, you know, a couple of days later stood up at a rally and said, we're going to make November 5th Christian Visibility Day. So he's leaning really hard into that kind of fighting message that, like, I'm fighting for Christianity, I'm fighting for you. So I think that explains a lot of the continued support. But, you know, it's worth noting that there are people that I write about ex-evangelicals who, some of whom have sort of disentangled from the evangelical label because of Trump, or they've seen this moment as kind of a moment to talk about other issues that they've seen brewing in evangelicalism for a long time that have kind of led to this moment.
Sure.
There are still something like 2 out of 10 white evangelicals that don't support Trump. So, you know, it's not, I mean, it's overwhelming, but not total support. And, you know, there are still, you know, those evangelical critical voices, people like David French and Russell Moore and others who have from the beginning been critics of Trump and continue to speak out against him and continue to say that he's not representing the kind of Christianity that they believe in. But, you know, I think by and large, the point I often make is I don't think that most, and there's polling that backs this up, I don't think most evangelicals think that Trump is a devout man. They don't expect him to be. That's not, you know, that's not the goal. It's about someone who they see as fighting the culture wars for them in many ways.
Yeah, you can be an advocate without being on the same team, I suppose. You've talked about a couple times in this conversation, use the term white evangelical church. And I mean, it's in the subtitle of your book as well. And there's a whole chapter in the book about race and the church. And in that chapter, you talk about attempts at integration and attempts at welcoming other people in that, at least as I understand it, have seemed to have not been super successful in a lot of cases. And there is still a need to distinguish white evangelicals from other evangelicals, it seems. Why is it, you think, that evangelicalism has been so white and remains so white?
A couple of different reasons. And I, you know, my editor and I had a conversation about whether or not we should put white in the subtitle. When I proposed the book, it was just the ex-evangelicals and it was subtitled TBD. But I, you know, I'm happy with what we came up with. And I think that it's important to distinguish when we're talking about the white evangelical church or the predominantly white evangelical church. Of course, these ideas cross racial lines and nothing neatly falls into any category when you're talking about religion. But you can't talk about American religion, American Christianity, without talking about race. The divisions along racial lines have existed from pretty much the beginning of the country.
Yeah.
The Southern Baptist Convention, which is shrinking, but still the largest evangelical denomination, came into existence as the Southern Baptist Convention because of slavery and segregation, because of leaders of what became the Southern Baptist Church not wanting to integrate and not wanting to support slavery.
Yeah.
Now, the church has apologized for that, of course, close to 30 years ago. And that's, you know, that is part of the history, though. And I think in talking to some of the Black Christians who I interviewed in the book who'd spent time in white evangelical spaces, you know, what they described to me was a sense that as much as white Christian leaders may have talked about wanting to integrate and even made efforts to, and I saw this in my own church growing up, those often were unsuccessful. And I think they would say for a variety of reasons, you know, there's a difference between hiring a Black pastor and really centering the Black experience and listening to the perspective of Black Christians who've lived a different history than white Christians have, and prioritizing that perspective and maybe changing one's politics or theology in response to it. Like, that's much harder to do than just putting somebody on the pastoral staff who looks a little bit different than the other guys. And usually they're all guys. And so what some of the folks I interviewed for the book described to me was a sense, particularly when the Trump moment came along, that the people in their churches might have said they wanted to be integrated and inclusive, but they were voting for people who were supporting policies that they felt were harmful. And that just sort of underscored the fact that rift is still there.
Yeah. We were talking about it with Trumpism, but I feel like it's worth talking about in a different context as well. And that's just kind of this very masculine, very patriarchal kind of tough guy image that gets cultivated in evangelical churches a lot. The idea of a male head of family that, you know, should be out there kind of fighting for his family and, you know, just that kind of rugged Americanism, I get. Like, I guess what I'm trying to get at is there's a lot of symbolism that seems parallel to kind of American symbolism and American military might and, you know, those sorts of things. I'm curious, you were looking primarily at white American evangelical churches in the book, but like, mm-hmm. do you have a sense of what the evangelical movement looks like elsewhere in the world? And like, is that kind of militaristic view of things or patriarchal view of things, is that unique to America, or is there something about it that's particularly American, or do we see that elsewhere?
I don't know. The short answer is I don't know, because I haven't done a lot of research on churches abroad. But what I do know from a little bit of research is just that the American evangelical church is very influential because of its size, power, money, and missionary work. And the fact that, you know, American evangelicalism, as I talk about in the book, has this really massive sort of subcultural infrastructure that's built up, you know, Christian publishing, broadcasting, universities, schools, some of which send curricula all over the world. Yeah. So I don't know. I haven't studied that, but I wouldn't minimize the influence of American evangelicalism on other branches of evangelicalism.
Yeah, that's interesting. You talked about publishing and stuff there. I'm curious too, just you described a lot about your childhood and sort of growing up in almost an alternate media reality to, you know, what kind of the mainstream, quote unquote, American culture was in, you know, the 80s and 90s. I'm curious if you could just talk about that for a minute of, you know, Christian music, Christian books, Christian television, that there is this whole different world out there that people who might not be familiar with it might not even realize exists.
Yeah, I think it was created in many ways as a response to the growing secularization of the country. And this is in many ways what the evangelical political movement is a response to as well, the sense that, you know, for many years now, and in a particularly accelerated rate now, white Christianity is on the decline as a share of the population. And this is for a couple of reasons. The population's becoming less white, more diverse, and it's also becoming more secular. I want to be careful not to conflate those two trends. They're separate trends.
Yeah.
In some ways, there's more stability in Christian churches of color. There's some loss there, too, from the data I've seen from groups like Public Religion Research Institute. But the most precipitous declines seem to be in white Christianity, both evangelicalism and Catholicism, as well as mainline Protestantism. And I think that white Christian leaders were aware of that. And, you know, some of it came out of just a concern of wanting to protect children from a culture that was seen as increasingly secular. The sexual revolution had happened. Women's roles were changing. And all of that was seen as kind of threatening to this traditional Christian culture that had dominated much of the country for a long time. So for me, that meant, you know, very limited kind of curated exposure to pop culture. It wasn't like there was none, but it was pretty tightly controlled. And yeah. Christian books, magazines, videos, every, you know, TV stations, radio stations were all prioritized. I went to Christian school. We had almost entirely our curriculum came from Christian publishers that were quite conservative and taught, you know, young earth creationism and so forth. And so that was kind of what shaped my world. And, you know, since the book published, I've heard from a lot of other former evangelicals or people who grew up similarly to the way I did, who said, oh my gosh, you know, this was my universe too, because it was a huge movement. You know, something like one in four Americans were white evangelicals in the early 90s.
Yeah.
You know, I talk about how James Dobson, the founder of Focus on the Family, had a mailing list of millions of people in the 1990s. And most of those people had children. And a lot of us are adults now. And so that's really what this book is about, is just sort of coming out of that subculture that was so specific. And, you know, I'll say one more thing about that. I wrote a piece for NPR quite a number of years ago after the singer Prince died, mm-hmm. about how, you know, it was really strange to watch everybody kind of, you know, just grieve and mourn the loss of this person. And I realized, you know, it was just yet another reminder of how different my childhood was, because I was, you know, I'd heard of him and I was aware of him, but like the idea of having a pop cultural figure that was so important, yeah. was just very foreign to me. You know, those were not the people that we worshiped. Yeah. And I wrote this essay about just feeling kind of at a remove from the culture that I theoretically grew up in. And it was interesting because I heard from a few other people who'd grown up in the evangelical world and very much resonated with that feeling. And I also heard from a couple of first generation Americans, like people who had grown up in immigrant families,
yeah.
with their own kind of different subculture, right? That they were also experiencing American culture at a little bit of a remove because their family context was a bit different than the other kids at school. And a couple of people said, you know, this is kind of how I feel about American culture. Like I grew up in it, but I didn't totally.
Interesting.
And I just thought it was fascinating, you know, how it's such a big country and we kind of have a shared culture, but we're also in our own little bubbles in a way.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting too, that there was a lot of crossover. Like, again, I wasn't an evangelical, but like, you know, we'd go to Chick-fil-A and get a kid's meal and get an Adventures in Odyssey like tape and book set. And like when I read that in your book, I'm like, oh yeah. And like my sister and I used to listen and had no idea that, you know, we're Sixpence None the Richer would come on the radio and they'd be like, you know, that's a Christian band. I'd be like, is it? Okay. I don't know. Like there was, especially in the 90s, I feel like there was just so much of that crossover. I'm curious, the book has been out now for, you know, a week or so. Like, what has the reaction been now that it's out in the world? Have you been hearing from readers or, you know, others that have engaged with it, and what are they taking away from it?
It's mostly been really positive. I have heard from a lot of people who grew up evangelical and also some Catholic and other traditions who said just that they really appreciate the book and they really feel like it captured their experience of also, you know, growing up with a specific worldview and having to go through this process that I think is just kind of part of maturing, of figuring out who you are in the world and who you want to be and how that lines up or doesn't with one's religious community, which I think in a country that's increasingly pluralistic, we have a lot of different kinds of people with different backgrounds, different religions, different traditions. We're called a melting pot, right? So it's, as an American, you interact with people from a variety of perspectives and life experiences if you're in a workplace or a public school or lots of other venues. And I think that sort of occasions some thought for people of going, okay, well, how do I make sense of difference? How do I make sense of the things I've been taught and the things versus the things I observe and experience? And so I've heard from a lot of people who resonate with that. I've also heard from a number of people who've said, this really helps me understand evangelical culture better and the thinking behind it. And I feel like I get kind of what's happening with our politics better than I did before. Some version of that I've heard from a few people. And that's great because that's really why I wrote the book. Like I wanted ex-evangelicals to feel seen and described. And I also wanted people with a distance from the movement, which is so influential and has had such an outsized impact on our politics and our culture in many ways, to just understand it better.
Yeah. I'm curious, like, you talk about your own spiritual journey, obviously, a lot in the book, and your husband is Jewish, and that seems to have had a big influence on you as well now. like for me, growing up Catholic, again, like the more I started to unwind it, like I couldn't unwind little pieces without undoing it all. Basically, it took me a decade or so to figure that out. But like you talk about people, you know, everywhere from still considering themselves Christian, but in a very different tradition, to, you know, atheist and everything in between. Like, what are your views, I guess, on spirituality or religion or just all, like, how do you think about yourself and your place in the world having gone through this this deconstruction process?
I think I'm someone who is just very curious, and I'm always sort of questioning and searching in a way. I think I have held on to some of the essential values that I got from my faith. And I, you know, I'm always quick to say that I don't think that these are, that you can only get these from Christianity or certainly evangelical Christianity. But for me, ideas like the value and dignity of every person, you know, the fact that the idea that every person is loved by God and is valuable and important is something that I, like, it's an idea I really treasure and still hold on to.
Yeah.
You know, and I hesitate to sort of lay out, like, here's what I believe about X, Y, and Z, because number one, I don't really think what I think matters that much.
Yeah.
And number two, I don't have hard and fast views on a lot of things, but I'm not, like, I will say pretty confidently, I'm not an atheist. I feel like there is something bigger than me. I have no interest in persuading other people to agree with me on that. That's just how I feel about it, you know?
Yeah.
And it has been helpful being in an interfaith relationship, because my husband has like his own very long tradition that has its own sort of language and culture around spirituality. And for me, as somebody who was raised with a sort of a rigid view of that, it's been instructive and informative and in a way kind of like inspiring to see how someone else interacts with those questions. You know, he's Reformed Jewish, so that's, you know, probably the least traditional, least conservative version of it.
Yeah.
Which probably, you know, works well with me being from a Christian background. Like, both of us are able to kind of hold our traditions with sort of an open hand and,
right,
and talk about them, but without having to feel like we, you know, we have to persuade the other person to think something specific. And it's a really interesting dialogue that we have, you know, around, well, like, what were you taught about this? And how do you think about this? And even just like learning about how, and I don't want to speak for all of Judaism, because I'm certainly not a scholar of Judaism, but just even talking to him and to some folks in his congregation about the idea of sin, like, that means something different to me, or it meant something different to me growing up than it, yeah, I think it does to him. And I don't know, I find that fascinating. Like, I'm just very interested too in kind of the history of religion and how it shapes people's cultures and traditions and certainly world politics. And so some of my, in some ways, my own spirituality, I think, bleeds into my interest in just sort of like the academic side of religion,
yeah,
which may sound weird, but that's kind of how it works for me.
No, I get it. I mean, I think what you're saying too is that it's personal to everybody. And like, going back to my childhood for a second, like, that's the piece that I wish I had heard growing up, instead of like, no, you have to understand this is the only way. Like, I wish any adult would have just said, I don't really know, but this seems to work for me, or, you know, this kind of feels right. And if it's not right for you, you can try something. You know, like, I wish I had heard that more, because it is very personal for everybody and you got to find it for yourself.
It is. And I mean, I think some people have a really strong sense of like the divine and like of communicating with God. And other people will say they've never felt anything like that. And I'm somewhere in between. Like, I've had experiences where I felt like gratitude or joy that felt it felt very spiritual to me, or often does. But like, you know, can I tell you for sure that that's God? I don't know. Like, yeah. I don't want to, I've never, and maybe it's because I'm a journalist, like, I never want to overstate what I know. And
right,
so it just feels dishonest.
Yeah.
It's not about being closed off to it. It's just about being like, I can't tell you for sure about some of these things, you know, and I would love to be able to, but I'm not going to misrepresent what I know and don't know.
All right. Sarah McCammon there. That was a lot. And I'm telling you, we barely scratched the surface. You want to read her book. You want to dig into this more. There is a lot to unpack, a lot to understand. Whether you come from a religious background like myself, or you did not get raised with the religion and you're trying to see it from the outside, Or maybe you come from a different world tradition, as Sarah was talking about there, and you're trying to understand what it is that makes the white evangelical space such a force in American politics right now. The Exvangelicals is the book for you. The Exvangelicals by Sarah McCammon, Loving, Living, and Leaving the White Evangelical Church. And of course, you can check out Sarah's work on NPR and co-hosting the NPR Politics podcast. Before we go, just a reminder, I have my newsletter that I publish twice a week, every Wednesday and every Sunday. Go to heathrasala.com/newsletter, get on the list there, and you will not only get my newest newsletter issues, you will also get alerted to every podcast episode. If you'd like to support the work that I do, you can upgrade to a paying membership and you will get early access to the podcast as well. Plus, you'll be helping me keep doing this work, talking to interesting people, shining a light on things that maybe aren't getting covered as much in the mainstream media. I hope you will consider that. I am at Heath Rosella on all social media platforms. Give me a follow. I'm on TikTok now too, at Heath Rosella. Excerpts from the podcast are over there. You might want to check those out. And I have a new podcast episode every 2 weeks. I will talk to you then. Until then, stay safe.